I'm going to read Come On, Sea Biscuit by Ralph Moody, Houghton Mifflin Company, 1963. We're on chapter 4. Father, thank you for watching over us in each place where we live, grandkids and children scattered around the country and even overseas. And you've put us together with the body of Christ where each of us lives. And I pray for faithful preaching of the word, for good handling of the Lord's Supper and baptism, and that when discipline is necessary, that we would be disciplined, that we would submit to the authorities that are over us, both within the church and within the government of the nation, and our cities and our states. Father, I thank you that as we start this chapter, we can acknowledge your goodness in all of creation as you keep and sustain us. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, since early colonial times, horse racing has been one of the most popular sports in America. By 1650, quarter-mile races were being run on paths cut through the woods near the larger settlements of Virginia and Maryland. Then, following the Revolutionary War, thoroughbreds were imported from England, racetracks were built near our larger cities, and the horsemen of this country went painstakingly about establishing and improving royal American thoroughbred families. Their efforts were rewarded when, nearly a century and a half later, Man O' War set 5 world speed records in the 11 races he ran as a 3-year-old. Ever since the time of the Roman Empire, men have taken tremendous pride in the speed of their fast horses, have raced them against each other, and have wagered on the outcome of the races. The demand for exceptionally fast racers became so great and their cost so high that only the nobility could afford to own them. So horse racing became known as the sport of kings. Originally, most of the wagering was done between these wealthy owners. But as the sport became popular, the common people began flocking to the races, choosing favorites, and betting with each other on the outcome. As a result, the races were held on courses near large centers of population. Admission was charged, and part of the money received was offered as prizes to the owners of the winning horses. The greater the crowd, the higher the prizes, so the fastest horses were usually raced near the largest cities. When this country won its independence and our government was formed, each state was empowered to pass laws for the regulation of activities within its borders. By that time, horse racing had become the most popular sport in the new nation, and wherever horses were raced, the fans thronged to the courses and bet on their favorites. But the churches were opposed to gambling. They were successful in having anti-wagering laws passed in New England and many of the new states established in the West. Until the anti-wagering laws were repealed, there was little or no horse racing in these states, for large crowds would attend the races only if they could bet on the outcome. But in New York, Pennsylvania, and the South, racing flourished. And there, the American thoroughbred was developed into the fastest horse on earth. As the population of our cities grew, New York became the horse racing capital of the United States. Other cities along the Atlantic coast and inland as far as the Mississippi River became lesser centers, but there was almost no thoroughbred racing in the West. When, in 1933, pari-mutuel wagering on horse races was legalized in California, Los Angeles sportsmen went all out to make their city one of the racing capitals of the world. In order to do it, they built multi-million dollar Santa Anita Park, the most luxurious horse racing plant in the United States. But that was not enough. The great racing stables with their top-notch thoroughbreds were all in the East. If Los Angeles were to become a racing capital, the finest horses in the land must be brought there to race. And owners would risk shipping their most valuable horses across the entire country only if the prizes to be won were well worth the risks. To entice the big owners in the East to ship their finest racers to Los Angeles, Charles H. Strub, general manager of Santa Anita Park, inaugurated the $100,000 Santa Anita Handicap, the richest horse racing stake ever to have been offered in the world. Building Santa Anita Park and bringing there the richest horse racing event in the world was an ambitious undertaking. But the fondest ambition of the California sportsman was to develop a horse capable of winning the great event against the fastest thoroughbreds the East could produce. They expected the task to take many years, for it had required more than a century to establish the royal thoroughbred families in the East, and the wealthy owners there would not give up a colt that showed promise of becoming a champion. The first glimmer of hope came for the Californians when Seabiscuit won the Scarsdale Handicap at Empire City, and then came west to set two successive track records at Bay Meadows. The leading California bookmaker immediately named him his favorite in the Santa Anita Handicap, to be run at the end of February, much to the ridicule of the railbirds in the East. They compared his record to Granville's and scoffed at his Bay Meadows records, saying that either the miles were shorter in California than in New York, or the stopwatches were slower. It is doubtful that the California bookmaker actually believed Seabiscuit capable of winning the Santa Anita Handicap, but there was no doubt of it in the minds of Charles Howard, Tom Smith, or Red Pollard. Beyond that, Mr. Howard was one of the sportsmen who had financed Santa Anita Park, and his fondest hope was to bring California the honor of producing a horse that could win its richest racing prize. Seabiscuit was shipped to Santa Anita in the middle of December, where it was planned to give him a few weeks rest, with just enough training to bring him into tip-top condition for the $100,000 handicap. But Ollie Olson nearly upset the plans. Soon after Seabiscuit was brought to California, Ollie had been hired as the colt's private groom. And like all of the little outcast's own folks, Ollie fell head over heels in love with him. Under Tom Smith's coaching, he learned to massage the weakened joints and tendons, to put on the knee braces, and to use exactly the right amount of liniment before bandaging the colt's legs with thick paddings of cotton. Each day, Tom weighed out the menu for the colt. So much cold bran mash for breakfast, so many pints of oats for dinner and supper, and exactly so many pounds of oat and timothy hay. Ollie slept in Seabiscuit's stall, called him baby, as Red Pollard did, and followed Tom Smith's instructions exactly in all but one way. He, like Seabiscuit, was a hearty eater, and it broke his heart to see baby being starved. Each night when Tom and Red were safely in bed and asleep, Ollie would sneak a generous hot bran mash into the stall just as a before-bedtime snack for baby. Then during the day, he smuggled in a few pints of oats in his pockets, and each pint went into speed-reducing fat on the colt's ribs. By the time Tom discovered what was going on, Seabiscuit was beginning to look like a prize beef steer, and no safe amount of exercise would keep him down to his best racing weight. But Tom found himself in a dilemma. Even under threats of firing, Ollie wouldn't stop smuggling, and Tom didn't dare fire him anyway. Seabiscuit had become so attached to his generous groom that he became very nervous and irritable when Ollie was not in his stall at night. At last, Tom had to appeal to Mrs. Howard, for Ollie worshipped her and would do whatever she told him, even to starving baby. For a few weeks, Tom Smith and Red Pollard had to exercise the colt briskly both morning and afternoon before they could strip him of his extra fat and round him again into racing condition. As always, the railbirds were on hand to watch the early morning workouts and to check the speed on their stopwatches. But Tom Smith, as he had done at other tracks, gave them little speed to check. While other trainers put their horses through a few fast workouts, the horses that showed the best time on the stopwatches were Rosemont and Time Supply, two of the best handicap horses from the East. So the railbirds made them favorites over Seabiscuit for the big race. When sharpening thoroughbreds for a very important race, most trainers like to start them in a couple of lesser races a week or two in advance. So warm-up races are usually scheduled on the racing program. At Santa Anita, the warm-up events were the Huntington Beach Handicap, run on February 9th, and the San Antonio Handicap, run on February 20th. Most of the horses that would start in the big race were entered, and Rosemont was one of the favorite at odds of 5-1, while Time Supply and Seabiscuit were 10-1. From the start of the Huntington Beach Handicap, it was evident the three favorites had not yet reached the peak of their racing form, but Seabiscuit was bubbling over with eagerness to run. He broke from his number 5 post position in full stride, caught the fast-sprinting leader, Cloud d'Or, before reaching the quarter post, and appeared to be tantalizing him through the backstretch, barely keeping a neck in front, but running effortlessly. Coming into the home stretch, Seabiscuit was a half length ahead. Then, without the slightest urging from Red Pollard, he turned on a blinding burst of speed, as if taunting the railbirds who had driven the betting odds against him to twice those against Rosemont. At the finish line, his ears were up and he was coasting, 6 full lengths ahead of Time Supply, with Rosemont another four lengths farther back. The San Antonio Handicap was the final rehearsal for the great $100,000 Santa Anita Classic, and 16 horses were entered. Because of his easy victory in the Huntington Beach, Seabiscuit was made the favorite at odds of 5-2, but finished fifth, four lengths behind Rosemont, the winner. He had drawn number 11 post position, was badly interfered with at the start, and in 12th place before he could reach the rail. He was still 12th at the three-quarter pole and blocked off by the tightly bunched horses in front of him. On the far turn, Red had to swing him very wide to get past, and they came into the home stretch, 8.5 lengths behind Rosemont. There was no possible chance of winning, but again, Seabiscuit put on an electrifying stretch run, gaining 4.5 lengths on Rosemont in the final furlough. Great as his race had been, his finishing out of the money was enough to drop him to third place among the favorites for the big race. February 27, 1937 was a warm, sunny day in Southern California. The track was in perfect condition for the Santa Anita Handicap, and so was Seabiscuit. Tom Smith had trained off every ounce of his fat, brought him to a hard, tough fitness, and had honed his racing instinct to rapier sharpness. Mr. Howard, Tom, and Red Pollard hadn't the slightest doubt that he could win, or would win, and had laid their plans for the race carefully. Through the early part of the race, in the backstretch, Seabiscuit was to be held just behind the leaders, then brought to the front while rounding the turn so there would be no danger of his being blocked while making his powerful drive down the home stretch. When, a few minutes after 4 o'clock, 18 of the fastest thoroughbreds in the world paraded to the post, more than 60,000 fans jammed the grandstand and overflowed into the infield. Among them were the railbirds, drawn as by a magnet from every part of the country. Doctors, lawyers, bootblacks, tourists, almost the entire Hollywood movie colony, and countless Californians who had trekked to Santa Anita in the hope of seeing Seabiscuit, their Cinderella, win the great racing classic. Beyond the finish line, the clubhouse and private boxes glittered with the elites of society and the racing world. The press box was crowded with sports writers from every big newspaper in the United States, and more than $1.5 million had already passed through the betting windows. With the race at 1.25 miles and the oval only 1 mile around, the start was from a straightaway shoot, a furlong beyond the farthest end of the grandstand. As the horses lined up in the gate, tall, handsome Rosemont near the outside and little Seabiscuit third from the rail, the huge throng stood in hushed silence, anxiously awaiting the running of the richest racing event in the world. Then, to the deafening roar of "They're off!", a wall of thoroughbreds broke from the gate like a swirling flood from a broken dam. From the grandstand and clubhouse, the shouting crowd could see little more than a seething mass of horses rushing toward it down the chute like a mighty torrent on a rampage. And above the surging river of horses, the jockeys in their bright silks tossed like cockle shells riding the crest of a flood. Seabiscuit was ninth away from the barrier. Through the turmoil of the first furlough, Red Pollard maneuvered him deftly, avoiding interference, shooting him through any opening that appeared, and jockeying for position. As the leader strung out and swept through for the first time past the cheering crowd in the grandstand, Red brought Seabiscuit easily into fourth place, then held him there past the clubhouse and into the first turn. Well out in the lead, the speedster, special agent, set a scorching pace early. Behind him streaked Box Thorn, one of the most highly regarded stake horses in the country, closely followed by gigantic Don Roberto. Far back, Harry Richards, the top stake-winning jockey of 1936, had gone to the whip, trying to bring Rosemont into contention from his poor starting position. Around the turn and up the backstretch, the four leaders held their positions like horses on a merry-go-round. Going into the far turn, Red hunched low over Seabiscuit's withers, touched him with his heels, and called on him to make his bid. He answered with a surge of speed that neither Don Roberto nor Boxthorn could match, passed them at the top of the turn, and bore down on the tiring special agent. As the Californians roared themselves hoarse and cheering on their Cinderella horse, he winged past special agent on the outside, turned into the home stretch leading by a head, gained the rail, and opened his lead to a full length. At the paddock runway, Tom Smith took the straw he'd been chewing from his mouth, and in the clubhouse, Mr. and Mrs. Howard glowed with pride and happiness. The race had gone exactly as they'd planned it, and with Seabiscuit a length out in front, they couldn't believe that any horse living had the slightest chance of catching him before he reached the wire. Unfortunately, Red Pollard had the same belief and let Seabiscuit hug close to the rail where the track was softest and slowest. But Harry Richards hadn't become top stake-winning jockey without learning all the tricks of the trade. Through the backstretch and around the turn, he had done the most skillful job of riding ever seen at Santa Anita, threading Roma's want through an opening that through any opening that showed, going to the whip when needed, but holding back enough of his mount's energy for a driving finish. Rounding into the near turn, he slipped past Don Roberto and Boxthorn, swept wide into the home stretch, and overhauled Special Agent. Keeping well off on the rail where the track was hard and fast, Richards drove for the wire with his whip lashing, and under the punishment, long-legged Rosamont ran as he had never run before. While the fans in the grandstand and the celebrities in the clubhouse were frantic with excitement, he shortened the gap between himself and short-legged Seabiscuit by a foot or more at every leap. The finish of the race was best described by Grant Land Rice, the most famous rider of his day. In his article in the Los Angeles Times, he wrote, "In the last 100 yards, Seabiscuit had the lead by half a length. But in that final swirl, it was Richards who went to the whip as he practically lifted Rosamont across. For some reason, Red Pollard left the whip in his scabbard, figuring he had the race in hand. But that final whiplash from Richards turned the $100,000 trick. It lifted Rosamont across the line by a foot or so, with Seabiscuit struggling desperately to hold the lead he had picked up through the finish. Other sports writers were less charitable, saying that Red had thrown the race away through lack of skill and judgment. Most of us are inclined to claim full credit for our successes, but to blame others or ill fortune for our failures and disappointments. The mark of sterling character in a man or woman is the ability to accept with understanding and kindness the disappointments and heartbreaks that have been caused by another's failures. Never in the history of horse racing has sterling character been more clearly demonstrated than in Seabiscuit's defeat in the Santa Anita Handicap of 1937. We all have some fond ambition, some goal we would rather attain than any other in life. If the attainment is little more than an idle dream, completely beyond our reach, the pain of giving it up is small. But to hold it in our grasp, then see it slip away at the last instant is heartbreaking. From the time Santa Anita Park was built, Mr. and Mrs. Howard's fondest hope had been to bring to their beloved California a winner for its own great racing classic. And ever since Tom Smith had patched up his first thoroughbred, he had yearned to develop a winner for the richest racing prize in the world. To have their hopes so nearly realized, then shattered in the final stride of the great classic, was a sad disappointment, but not heartbreaking. Their heartbreak was for Seabiscuit, the knobby-kneed, gallant little outcast that had given them his very best, and through no fault of his own had lost his one big chance to attain greatness. There wasn't the slightest doubt in Mr. and Mrs. Howard or Tom Smith's mind that Seabiscuit was the fastest and most courageous racehorse in the world. But though they wouldn't admit it even to themselves, they knew that his chance of attaining greatness was now less than 1 in 1,000. No colt so abused as he had been in his early racing career had ever held up for more than a couple of years. Regardless of what care was given him, the injury to his leg joints and tendons could never be fully healed, and it was just a matter of time before they would break down under the terrific strain of racing. If he could have won the Santa Anita Handicap with his $100,000 prize, he might have been able to pass Granville's record for winnings in a single year. Without the big prize that had slipped away in the final stride, the task seemed entirely hopeless. It could be accomplished only by winning 8 or more of the richest stakes open to horses above 3 years old. And that would be a task for a superhorse, not a little one, with weak knees. But for consistent stake winners are handicapped by being required to carry tremendous loads. Heartbroken as Mr. and Mrs. Howard and Tom Smith were at Seabiscuit's having lost his bid for greatness, their grief was small compared to Red Pollard's. Ever since the day he had first leaned on the colt's stall door, the affection between them had grown and their confidence in each other had strengthened. Red needed no one to tell him that he had let the affection and confidence lose the race, that a few clips of the whip through the homestretch would have sent Baby under the wire an easy winner. Many a jockey has been dropped by a racing stable or berated by owner and trainer for losing a race that he should have won. But neither Mr. and Mrs. Howard nor Tom Smith had a word of criticism for Red Pollard. They had only compassion for his grief, acknowledged that their own overconfidence had been as much to blame for the loss as his, and defended him stoutly against the critics who tried to belittle his skill or judgment. Although they knew there was barely more than a hope that Seabiscuit's knees and tendons could hold up that long, they told Red, "Forget about this race. We were all in it together and lost because we were too sure of ourselves. but we know we have the best horse in the world. We'll win many another race before this year is over, and next year we'll come back and win the big one. The last important event of the Santa Anita season was a $10,000 San Juan Capistrano handicap to be run on the Saturday following the big race. Though the prize for the winner was only a tenth as much, the interest of the fans was nearly as great, for the race was at a mile and an eighth, and Indian Broom, the world's record holder that distance, had been nominated, together with this speed-bursting stablemate special agent. The ideal race would be one in which all the horses were exactly matched in speed and endurance. But this is impossible, for a horse's speed will vary with the fineness of the edge to which he has been trained, the amount of rest he has had between races, the condition of the track, the distance to be run, and numerous other factors. In order to equalize the speed of all horses in race as much as possible, a system of handicap has been devised. It is known as It is based on the knowledge that a horse's speed is slowed by about 2 lengths to the mile for every additional pound of weight he is required to carry. Every track has a racing secretary or professional handicapper who studies the recent performances of each horse nominated for a race, then assigns the additional weight, if any, that each shall carry. And to bring the weight of the jockey, saddle, and pad up to the requirement, lead plates are inserted in the saddle pad. In the Santa Anita handicap, Seabiscuit, carrying 115 pounds, had barely caught Special Agent at a mile and an eighth. And Indian Broom, carrying 116 pounds, had moved up to take third place, a length and a half behind Rosemont. On the theory that an extra pound of weight slows a horse 2 lengths to the mile, Indian Broom, the world's record holder, should have beaten Seabiscuit by more than half a length if they had been carrying equal weight. But in setting the weights for the San Juan Capistrano handicap, Seabiscuit was required to carry 120 pounds, Indian Broom only 118, and Special Agent 116. When the handicap weights for the San Juan Capistrano race were announced, Mr. Howard had felt them to be unfair. He was reluctant to enter Seabiscuit and did so only because of the clamor of the fans and the urging of Tom Smith. Tom knew how anxious Red was to redeem his loss in the big race, and he knew that Seabiscuit would have no trouble in carrying the 120-pound load. In their late afternoon sessions, he and Red had been breezing the stout-hearted four-year-old with loads as high as 125 pounds and found him as eager and able as ever to turn on top speed. Their only regret was that Rosemont wouldn't be entered in the Capistrano. 10 horses went to the post, but to the 45,000 fans who thronged the grandstand, there were only 3 that counted: Seabiscuit, Indian Broom, and Special Agent, the last 2 owned by the same stable. No fan watching that race could have failed to see that Red Pollard was out to prove Seabiscuit a better horse than Rosemont, even though the winner of the Santa Anita was not in the race. And no horseman could have failed to see that Seabiscuit was fully as determined as Red. At the sound of the starter's bell, Red sent Seabiscuit quickly into the lead with a smack or two of his whip. Then Special Agent shot by them as though he were running a quarter-mile dash. Without the slightest urging, Seabiscuit answered the challenge in a sizzling burst of speed. Matching stride for stride, they sped past the howling crowd in the grandstand a half dozen lengths in front of the pack, then flew into the first turn like frightened antelopes. There, Red sat back on the reins, pulling the overeager Seabiscuit to a reasonable pace. It was clear to him that they were being caught in a trap. Special Agent was being used as a decoy to steal the race for Indian Broom. His jockey had obviously been instructed to set a pace fast enough to run Seabiscuit into exhaustion during the first mile, that Indian Broom would be brought up to win in a homestretch sprint. All through the backstretch, Red held Seabiscuit a length or two behind Special Agent, then turned him loose to let him make his bid. In a score of tremendous leaps, he caught the towering front runner at the top of the turn, then ran shoulder to shoulder with him into the homestretch. Scientists tell us that a horse has no reasoning ability, that all his actions are governed by instinct and training. Even so, a highly intelligent horse has the ability to sense a situation with such keenness that it is closely akin to reasoning. And few thoroughbreds ever match Seabiscuit for intelligence. There was never a finer demonstration of it than in the finish of the San Juan Capistrano handicap. One might almost have believed he had been reading the sports pages, knew the criticism that had been heaped upon his friend Red Pollard, and was determined to avenge it. Beyond that, he appeared to thoroughly understand the trap that had been set by the trainer of Special Agent and Indian Broom, and to be ridiculing him for trying such foolishness. Running shoulder to shoulder with Special Agent, Seabiscuit was little more than coasting, for his ears were up and he never once snorted his usual challenge. As they rounded the turn into the home stretch, Indian Broom's jockey went to the whip, bringing the world's record holder up fast to steal the race in the final furlong. But something went wrong. Seabiscuit appeared to have been lying back and waiting for that move. With no urging from Red, but with a burst of speed that neither Indian Broom, Rosemont, nor any other living horse could have matched, he streaked for the finish wire. It was as though he was showing the critics what he couldn't tell them, that Red had not been at fault in failing to use the whip in their big race, that the fault had been his own overconfidence. With Red Pollard standing in the stirrups, holding him back with his full weight, and with a frenzied crowd roaring, "Bring on Rosemont, bring on Rosemont," Seabiscuit hurled his 120-pound load across the finish line to break the track record by 4/5 of a second. Special Agent and Indian Broom, with their lighter loads, trailed 8 lengths behind, so exhausted that they were being passed by Grand Manitou, a rank outsider. There was no doubt in anyone's mind that Seabiscuit, in 1 minute and 48 and 2/5 seconds, had more than redeemed himself, his owners, his trainer, and his jockey. The sports writers who had been more critical the week before were now the loudest in their praises. Jockey Jack Pollard, whose slightly overconfident finish on Seabiscuit lost the big race in Rosemont last Saturday, redeemed himself with one of the finest saddle exhibitions of the season. They're toasting a new champion today, Seabiscuit. The short-coupled little 4-year-old son of Hardtack and Swing On proved definitely superior to Rosemont by comparison as he handled his top weight of 120 pounds with ease and dashed to a new track record. In a breathtaking performance which easily overshadowed Rosemont's triumph in the $100,000 stake, Seabiscuit thrilled 45,000 cheering racegoers as he crushed his rivals under a stinging defeat. He proved himself a real champion and may rule the stakes division on the American turf this year. Certainly, he will run Rosemont dizzy if they ever hook up again. That's the end of chapter 4. Fun to read about the author's description of horse intelligence. So, love you guys. Have a good day where you are.